expected, only it was infinitely better expressed. He closed with another typically Adam salvo against the peevish and fretful effusions of politicians who are not worth remembering, much less of laying to heart. I salute your fireside with cordial esteem and affection. Then signed off as J.A. in the 89 year of his age, still too fat to last much longer. And so, even though both men were posturing for posterity, there is considerable truth in the classical portrait of Adams and Jefferson as reunited sages, speaking to each other and then across the ages to us in their unique role as American originals. At least one would be hard-pressed and at the same point reduced to sardonic laughter to find an equivalent level of literacy and intellectual sophistication among all the retired presidents of American history. Another picture, however, contains additional pieces of the truth that are especially important for an understanding of Jefferson's mentality in his final years. In this picture, Jefferson is standing tall and straight, with arms folded across his chest, as was his custom, and Adams is briskly pacing back and forth in front of him, talking in his mile-a-minute style, periodically stopping to grab Jefferson by the lapels to make his controversial and animated points. There really was a good deal of unfinished business between the two patriarchs, especially if Adams was determined to take seriously, as he obviously was, his conviction that they ought not to die before explaining themselves to each other. Adams was perhaps the one man in the world capable of challenging, often in a defiantly aggressive fashion, Jefferson's most cherished convictions about what the American Revolution had truly meant. Jefferson liked to distinguish between his genuine affection for Adams as a wise and courageous man of unimpeachable character, one of the original band of brothers who made the American Revolution happen, and his disagreement with the Adams brand of political thinking. As he put it to Rush, he had always defended Adams's character, with the single exception as to political opinions. But given Adams's seamless integration of politics and personality, this was a bit like saying that one always listened loyally to the Pope, except when he spoke on matters of faith and morals. In addition, Adams enjoyed a certain psychological superiority over Jefferson on the basis of age and of having preceded Jefferson in each of their mutual missions, in the Continental Congress in the 1770s, Europe in the 1780s, Vice President in the 1790s, and then the presidency. Although Adams was joking when he described Jefferson as his youthful disciple, there was at least a kernel of truth to the joke. For all these reasons, Jefferson tended to defer to Adams in much the same manner that his own protégés, Madison, Monroe, Gallatin, deferred to him. Moreover, while the other Federalist leaders, chiefly Hamilton and Marshall, were unadulterated enemies who stood clearly on the far side of the moral line in Jefferson's mind that separated the forces of light and the forces of darkness, Adams seemed to straddle that line, in fact, to deny that such a line even existed. He simply did not fit neatly into any of the Jeffersonian categories. To top it all off, Adams had a maddeningly effusive style of writing that accurately mirrored his famously unbuckled brand of conversation, in which one idea ricocheted off another at such unpredictable angles and high velocities that the notion of a prudent and diplomatic exchange that avoided the unsafe subjects was inherently impossible. Perhaps the most graphic point of contention, which also exposed how much both men had invested in shaping the story of the Revolution to enhance their own respective reputations, involved their memories of the Declaration of Independence. When the document was first published and sent out to the world in 1776, only the delegates to the Continental Congress had known that Jefferson was the principal author. Not until the middle of the 1780s, when Jefferson was in Paris, was there any public recognition of a linkage between the words of the Declaration and any one person. Over the ensuing years, however, as the 4th of July became the established occasion to celebrate the nation's birthday, Jefferson's association with the language of the Declaration became firmly established, and his reputation ascended alongside the hallowed text. Madison's last official act as president in the spring of 1817 was to select four paintings by John Trumbull for the Capitol Rotunda, which was being restored after being burned by the British during the War of 1812. The first selection was Trumbull's depiction of Jefferson handing over his draft of the Declaration to the President of the Continental Congress, with Adams and the other members of the drafting committee in the background. One can sense the throbbing Adams ego just beneath the surface of all his complaints about the symbolism of the scene. In 1819, for example, a document surfaced in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, purporting to date from March 1775, more than a year before the Declaration was written, and containing language that was eerily similar to the sacred text itself. The implication was clear. If authentic, the Mecklenburg resolves cast a shadow over Jefferson's claim to originality. Adams rather mischievously asked Jefferson whether he knew anything about this surprising discovery. Jefferson responded immediately, suggesting that the Mecklenburg resolves were almost certainly a forgery, and in any event, he had never seen them before. Although Adams wrote back to Jefferson to say he took him at his word, he told other friends just the opposite. "I could as soon believe that the dozen flowers of the hydrangea now before my eyes were the work of chance," he gossiped, "as that the Mecklenburg resolutions and Mr. Jefferson's declaration were not derived the one from the other." In general, however, Adams tended not to question the authenticity of Jefferson's authorship, so much as the significance of the drafting process, or even the declaration itself. In the Adams version of the story, first presented in his autobiography and then subsequently conveyed in letters to anyone who asked, the drafting committee had appointed him chair of the two-person subcommittee composed of Jefferson and himself. Then he had delegated the actual drafting chore to Jefferson. When this version got back to Jefferson, he immediately recognized that Adams was attempting to steal a share of the credit and agency for the magic words, pushing himself forward in the Trumbull portrait, if you will, and he quickly issued a polite but firm rejoinder. "Mr. Adams's memory has led him into unquestionable error. At the age of 88, and 47 years after the transactions of independence, this is not wonderful. Nor should I, at the age of 80, on the small advantage of that difference only, venture to oppose my memory to his, were it not supported by written notes, taken by myself at the moment and on the spot." Jefferson's notes, which he transcribed into his own autobiography, showed that he and Adams had indeed consulted before the drafting process began, but that the consultation had been misremembered into the actings of a subcommittee. There was no partnership, even of an administrative sort, at the moment of creation. Jefferson went out of his way to disavow any pretense of philosophical originality in the Declaration. As Madison so succinctly put it, Jefferson's goal was to assert, not to discover, truths, and to make them the basis of the Revolutionary Act. But in so doing, Jefferson insisted, he acted alone. Historical jockeying of this sort might seem petty in retrospect, but it graphically illustrated how both men fully recognized the symbolic significance the Declaration had achieved, even in their lifetimes, and therefore how much their places in the American pantheon depended upon their association with its creation. That very fact rankled Adams more than anything else. Was there ever a coup de théâtre that had so great an effect as Jefferson's penmanship of the Declaration of Independence? He asked Rush. He was candid enough to tell Jefferson that the significance of the Declaration was vastly overrated. It was like children's play at marbles or pushpin, dress and ornament rather than body, soul, and substance. No one at the Continental Congress, he claimed, regarded the language of the Declaration as anything more than eloquent propaganda. It was merely a theatrical sideshow that subsequent generations had made into the main event. As a result, Jefferson ran away with the stage effect and all the glory of it. What, then, was the true story of the American Revolution? Both men agreed that it would probably go to the grave with them and never find its way into the history books. Adams liked to note the proliferation of falsified accounts already contaminating the record and the self-serving memoirs that, as he and Jefferson could testify, were fictitious versions of what was really said in the corridors and at private meetings where the real decisions were made. Jefferson concurred that only the external facts would ever get into the written histories, and that the life and soul of history must forever be unknown. In the Adams version of the true story, however, the culminating moment was not July 4, 1776, and the decisive document was not the Declaration of Independence. The war itself was already raging by that time. Most of the delegates to the Continental Congress declared the Declaration as a ceremonial confirmation of what had already occurred. Its chief practical value, apart from publicizing a foregone conclusion in lyrical terms, was to enhance the prospects of a wartime alliance with France. And all the revolutionary leaders understood the French alliance to be the urgent issue at the time. Jefferson's declaration was like the thunder in an electrical storm. It made much noise, but the lightning had flashed earlier and already done the real work. For Adams, the culminating moment had occurred on May 15, 1776, when the Continental Congress passed a resolution, not so coincidentally he had proposed it, calling for new constitutions in each of the states. This was the decisive act, as Adams saw it, for three reasons. First, it was the decision that required the creation of separate and independent American governments. Second, the resolution stipulated that each state call a convention to draft its constitution, thereby endorsing the doctrine of popular sovereignty, the hallowed idea that the people were the source of all authority and the original of all power. Third, and most tellingly for the Adams version, it meant that the American Revolution was a responsible and positive commitment to new forms of political discipline, not just an irresponsible and negative assertion of separation from England based on a seductive promise of unlimited liberation. According to Adams, Jefferson was one of the few, perhaps the only participant in the debates, to take the language of the Natural Rights section of the Declaration seriously as a clean and thoroughgoing break with the accumulated political wisdom of the past. On the other hand, according to Jefferson, if Adams was right, the American Revolution was not really a revolution at all. This seminal disagreement exposed the underlying tension throughout the Adams-Jefferson correspondence. It never came completely to the surface for a full and free exchange of views, because neither man wished to place their latter-day reconciliation at risk. The diplomatic imperatives of the dialogue, in effect, made it impossible for the American patriarchs to fulfill the Adams promise and explain themselves to each other before they died. Indeed, if Jefferson had had his way, the sensitive subjects would have been avoided altogether, in part because he despised conflict just as much as Adams relished it, and in part because his affection for Adams was more important to him than any clarification of their political differences. As a result, their correspondence is like those high-level diplomatic statements that policy specialists study for pregnant silences and shaded meanings. The central dynamic of the dialogue tended to follow an episodic pattern. Jefferson would inadvertently raise one of the volatile issues and touch off a round of Adams's verbal airbursts, which momentarily illuminated their ideological differences, then the exchange would settle back to its idyllic mode. One such episode, in fact, was occasioned by the very term ideology. This was one of those new words that both men believed should be allowed to fight their way into the lexicon. Jefferson first used it in 1816 in reference to the writings of Destutt de Tracy, a French philosophe who had popularized the term in France. "What does it mean?" asked Adams. "I was delighted with it upon the common principle of delight in everything we cannot understand. Does it mean idiotism, the science of non-compomenticism, the science of lunacy?" The Adams list of preposterous and humorous definitions went on for several lines, along with the mock suggestion that since this was obviously one of those French words that Jefferson now wished to smuggle into the American language, it should be obliged to pay an import duty. But beneath the comic veneer, Adams wanted to smuggle into his own dialogue with Jefferson a deadly serious point, namely that Jefferson's style of political thinking was much indebted to the invention of the word ideology. because Jefferson harbored a set of attractive ideals, like the belief in human perfection or social equality, that he mistakenly believed could be implemented in this world merely because they existed in his head. This was the French way of thinking about politics, an a priori and implicitly utopian habit of mind that, as Adams called it, he and Jefferson had encountered in pre-revolutionary Paris in the conversations of Lafayette, Turgot, and Condorcet. It was an intellectual tradition that Adams described as the school of folly, for its systematic confusion of what one could imagine with what was practical and possible. He was essentially accusing Jefferson of embracing attractive dreams, then condemning all critics of his naivete as enemies of the goals themselves, when in fact they were only criticizing their illusory character. It was the classic criticism of an idealist by a realist. Another illuminating airburst occurred in 1816, when Jefferson, while attempting to make the apparently harmless point that one ought not to wallow in grief, asked the rhetorical question, "What is the use of grief on the human economy, and of what good is it the cause?" Adams proceeded to explode in a series of tirades on the uses of grief, a subject on which he claimed to be one of America's leading experts. Grief, as he saw it, was a crucial human emotion that sharpens the understanding and softens the heart. Grief was to human achievement as the thorn was to the roses. Had Jefferson never noticed that the portraits of statues of all the great men of history showed their faces filled with furrows of grief? Jefferson tried to send up the white flag. To the question, indeed, on the utility of grief, no answer remains to be given. You have exhausted the subject. But Adams was just getting started. Besides the various uses of grief, there were many more abuses of grief, including, Jefferson could certainly appreciate this one, the misuse of Washington's reputation by Hamilton to gain support for his banking schemes. Grief, it turned out, was a many-sided and many-splendored emotion. Jefferson tried to counter the Adams onslaught with the clever argument that, since there seemed to be an equal number of uses and abuses of grief, then perhaps they canceled each other out and therefore rendered the entire subject superfluous. Adams could not have disagreed more. The study of human emotions was the statesman's highest duty, Adams claimed. Our passions possess so much metaphysical subtlety and so much overpowering eloquence that they insinuate themselves into the understanding and the conscience and convert both to their party. Jefferson's unshakable faith in the eventual triumph of human reason over prejudice and superstition was, Adams conceded, an admirable hope. But as far as he was concerned, and as the whole sweep of history showed, it would seem that human reason and human conscience, though I believe there are such things, are not a match for human passions, human imaginations, and human enthusiasm. It was the classical debate between a rationalist and an empiricist. Finally, there was the most sustained and direct exchange over political principles in the entire correspondence. Jefferson accidentally started it with a familiar and, he must have thought, wholly unexceptional statement of the Jeffersonian vision of political parties. The same political parties which now agitate the U.S. have existed through all time. Whether the power of the people, or that of the aristoi, should prevail, were questions which kept the states of Greece and Rome in eternal convulsions, as they now schismatize every people whose minds and mouths are not shut up by the gag of a despot. To me it appears that there have been party differences from the first establishment of governments to the present day. Everyone takes his side in favor of the many or the few. As he quickly realized, Jefferson had wandered into the most dangerous political territory of all, for the Jeffersonian formulation rendered all political history into a moral clash between benevolent popular majorities and despotic elites, which in turn cast Adams and the Federalists in the unsavory role of the corrupt guardians of the privileged few, systematically defying the will of the American majority. Obviously, this was not a rhetorical posture that Adams would find comfortable or acceptable. Even the ever-combative sage of Quincy, sensed that this was heavily mined ground that demanded caution. His first instinct was to search for a safe haven. "Precisely," he wrote back to Jefferson, "the distinction between the few and the many was as old as Aristotle. One reason why he had claimed that politics, unlike the other sciences, was little better understood, little better practiced now than 3,000 or 4,000 years ago." And if Jefferson meant that the American Revolution had committed the new nation to the Lockean principle of popular sovereignty, that is, the doctrine that all political power derived from the people, then they were in perfect agreement. But, and here Adams began to touch the explosive charges buried beneath their friendship, the simple dichotomy between benign majorities and malevolent elites worked better as rhetoric than as a description of political reality. Danger could come from several directions, from the many as well as the few. "The fundamental article of my political creed," Adams announced defiantly, "is that despotism or unlimited sovereignty or absolute power is the same in a majority of a popular assembly, an aristocratical council, an oligarchical junta, and a single emperor." The full implications of this exchange were too threatening to the friendship for either man to pursue them to their logical conclusion in the correspondence. Adams moved the dialogue to a collateral issue, the character of aristocracies, which he recalled that Jefferson had urged him to write about when they were together in Paris, claiming that he had been writing on the subject ever since, the only problem being that "I have been so unfortunate as never to make myself understood." The core of the Adams position was that elites had always been and always would be a permanent fixture in society. Why? Because inequalities of mind and body are so established by God Almighty in his constitution of human nature that no art or policy can ever plane them down to a level. Adams went on a long and colorful tirade against the illusion of social equality, concluding that he had never read reasoning more absurd, sophistry more gross, in proof of the Athanasian creed or transubstantiation, than the subtle labors to demonstrate the natural equality of mankind. Now it was Adams who was trespassing on Jefferson's most cherished ground, essentially calling the Jeffersonian ideal of human equality a seductive delusion that mischievously confused a fond hope, i.e. ideology, with the messier and less attractive social realities. In effect, he was accusing Jefferson of telling Americans what they wanted to hear, leaving Adams with the more difficult task of telling them what they needed to know. Jefferson recognized that the correspondence had drifted into one of those volatile subjects on which he and Adams could never agree. "We are both too old to change opinions," he acknowledged, "which are the result of a long life of inquiry and reflection." Nevertheless, he attempted to rescue the exchange from an embarrassing impasse by making what he hoped would be two face-saving distinctions. First, he suggested that Adams' view of aristocratic power was appropriate for Europe, where feudal privileges, family titles, and more limited economic opportunities created conditions that sustained class distinctions. In America, on the other hand, the elimination of primogeniture and entail and the existence of an unspoiled continent meant that everyone may have land to labor for himself as he chooses, so enduring elites were highly unlikely here. Second, Jefferson distinguished between the natural aristocracy, based on virtue and talent, and the pseudo-aristocracy, founded on wealth and birth without either virtue or talents. Adams's strictures against aristocracy, he suggested, were really warnings against the pseudo-aristocracy, which Jefferson agreed was a mischievous ingredient in government, and provision should be made to prevent its ascendancy. Given the favorable laws and the abundant land of America, it was reasonable to expect that rank and birth and tinsel aristocracy will finally shrink into insignificance. Adams would have none of it. "Your distinction between natural and artificial aristocracy," he insisted, "does not appear to me well-founded. One might be able to separate wealth and talent in theory, or imagine idealistic worlds where they were not mutually dependent, ideology again, but in the real world they were inextricably connected in ways that defied Jefferson's theoretical dissections. Adams was also critical of Jefferson's vision of a classless American society. "No romance could be more amusing," he chided, "since the wide-open American environment would only ensure more massive inequalities and more unequal accumulations of property unless government stepped in to redistribute the wealth. Unless one believed that human nature had somehow changed in the migration from Europe to America, the disproportionate power of the few would bedevil political life in the American nation, too. The Jeffersonian ideal of social equality, in short, was an illusion, and by maintaining the pretense that it was a reality, one only enhanced the likelihood of making matters worse." Here was another classic confrontation, indeed the most explicit political argument in the correspondence, though it defies a simple label. Liberal versus conservative will not quite do. Perhaps one can call it the clash between a romantic optimist and an enlightened pessimist. When Rush had referred to Adams and Jefferson as the North and South Poles of the American Revolution, he was probably intending to make a purely geographic point, but the dialogue between the New Englander and the Virginian revealed that Rush's metaphor had much more sweeping implications. Beneath the idyllic and somewhat contrived veneer as American sages, the two aging revolutionaries created a dialogue between two distinctive and different understandings of just what the American Revolution meant as a political movement. For most of his adult life, Jefferson had regarded the spirit of 76 and the doctrines of pure republicanism as unequivocally clear expressions of a clean break with the past and with all traditional forms of political organization that imposed unnecessary limitations on personal freedom. He had therefore concluded that the Federalists were traitors who had betrayed these allegedly self-evident principles in favor of a coercive federal government that restored the very institutional mechanisms the Revolution was intended to remove. Now here was Adams, whose credentials as a maker and shaper of the American Revolution could not be denied, insisting that this version of the story was not what he remembered, indeed suggesting that Jefferson's understanding was highly idiosyncratic in its emphasis on a radical break with the past and its anti-government ethos. At the symbolic and psychological level, Jefferson's 14-year dialogue with Adams is important because Jefferson found it impossible to dismiss his irascible old colleague. Despite the aversion to conflict, he allowed Adams to draw him into an extended argument that created a literary monument to their beloved revolution as a complex event with multiple meanings. They were the proverbial opposites that attracted. For if the American Revolution had become a national hymn, they were its words and its music. The ironies abound, since the self-made son of a New England farmer and shoemaker was insisting that neither individual freedom nor social equality was ever a goal of the revolutionary generation, while the Virginia aristocrat with an inherited plantation of lands and slaves was insisting that both were. At the same time that Jefferson was beginning to develop his idea of the University of Virginia as a capstone to his career and a monument to his legacy, he was inadvertently, and at times against his own instincts, creating with Adams what turned out to be the ultimate literary monument to the American Revolution as an ongoing argument between idealistic and realistic impulses. In his last letter to Adams, written just before he slid into his final illness, Jefferson asked if his grandson and namesake, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, or Jeffy, might pay a visit to the sage of Quincy during his visit to Boston. "Like other young people," Jefferson explained, "he wishes to be able, in the winter nights of old age, to recount to those around him what he has heard and learnt of the heroic age, and which of the Argonauts particularly he was in time to have seen. Like mythical gods frozen into classical postures, Jefferson and Adams had become living statues to the rising generation." What their correspondence preserved for posterity was the dynamic and contentious character of the revolution they had mutually fought and wrought. Retrospectives. If their correspondence was a bit like a posed picture, periodically rescued from a still-life version of the American Revolution by Adams's inability to sit still or hold his tongue, it is worth noting that both men had been posing for many years. Like all the leading members of the revolutionary generation, Adams and Jefferson had early on developed a keen sense of themselves as founding fathers, with a prominent place in the history books. Adams, after all, had begun to make copies of all his letters in 1776, and Jefferson had been preserving most of his correspondence since 1782. Alfred North Whitehead once observed that there were only two instances in recorded history when the political leadership of an emerging empire performed as well as one could realistically expect. The first was Rome under Caesar Augustus, and the second was the United States in the Revolutionary Era. While historians have offered several explanations for this remarkable explosion of leadership at the very start of the American Republic, and it truly was remarkable, the self-conscious sense that the future was watching elevated the standards and expectations for all concerned. At least in a small way, we are complicitous in their achievement because we were the ultimate audience for their performances. While Jefferson had never been oblivious to the matter of posterity's judgment, in about 1816 his interest in what history would say about him intensified. The obvious reason for this discernible shift was age. Whatever revisions or additions he might wish to make for the historical record could not wait much longer because his time was running out. The correspondence with Adams, by forcing him into a dialogue with a lovable antagonist, probably also prompted his retrospective tendencies. In 1816, moreover, he was drawn into the debate about William Wirt's highly successful biography of Patrick Henry. Wirt had consulted Jefferson about the sources of Henry's histrionic style. "You have given them quite as much luster as themselves would have asked," Jefferson apprised Wirt, thereby expressing in diplomatic fashion his long-standing opinion that Henry was vastly overrated. Jefferson suggested only one revision, a passage in which Wirt described Henry actually reading a book. "The study and learning ascribed to him in this passage," Jefferson so delicately observed, "would be inconsistent with the excellent and just picture of his indolence through the rest of the work." In partial compensation for the obvious fact that he despised Henry, Jefferson allowed himself to be quoted in the published book to the effect that Henry deserved credit for fomenting opposition to British policies in the 1760s, saying that "Mr. Henry certainly gave the first impulse to the ball of revolution." This apparently harmless remark produced a loud howl from several New Englanders, including the ever-ready Adams, who interpreted the celebration of Henry's early efforts in behalf of American independence as a sly plot to make Virginia, rather than Massachusetts, the real cockpit of the Revolution. Jefferson expressed his surprise at the vehemence of the New England retaliation. He was the last man to champion Henry as a significant figure, and the whole argument about who was first was silly, like asking who discovered gravity. But the debate dragged on. Adams was inspired to put forward James Otis of Massachusetts as Henry's predecessor in the contest for primacy as the first American revolutionary, until Jefferson issued a concession. He had never meant to intercept the just fame of Massachusetts for the promptitude and perseverance of her early resistance. He was even willing to cede her the title as the cradle of independence, though he felt obliged to add that with regard to principles of the Revolution, some of us believe that she had deflected from them in her course, even as we retain full confidence in her ultimate return to them. Jefferson preferred to avoid such trivial arguments about specific events or personalities, except when the contested topic was the Declaration of Independence. There he was ready to defend his own version against all encroachments, sensing that it was the historical equivalent of the mother lode. His major concern was the larger outline of the story that would get passed down to posterity about the meaning of the American Revolution. Madison's retirement from the presidency in 1817 raised expectations that his old partner in the political wars would devote his energies to writing a Jeffersonian version of American history. He urged Madison to apply your retirement to the best use possible, to a work which we have both wished to see well done. He promised to place all his personal letters and notes entirely at your command. As in the party battles of the 1790s, Jefferson wanted Madison to take the point. It was essential to his own stature, as well as a temperamental imperative, that Jefferson himself remain behind the scenes and above the fray. But this time, Madison pleaded declining health and sheer fatigue and turned down the invitation. As Jefferson saw it, this left the field almost entirely in the hands of the enemy. Hamilton's son, it was well known, was already writing a biography of his father, which would, Jefferson warned, surely promote the rancor of the fiercest Federalism. Then there was that treasure trove of un-Jeffersonian wisdom stockpiled at Quincy. Mr. Adams's papers, Jefferson noted ominously, and his biography, will descend, of course, to his son, John Quincy Adams, whose pen is pointed, and his prejudices not in our favor. All the old moral dichotomies took command of Jefferson's imagination again. The Whigs versus the Tories, the Republicans versus the Federalists, pure republicanism versus corrupted impostors. Having won all the major battles during their lifetimes, Jefferson feared that he and his political disciples were about to lose the decisive war for posterity after they were dead. In fact, the chief traitor had already struck and littered the historical record with lies that, again, as Jefferson saw it, falsified the true story of the American Revolution beyond recognition. The culprit was none other than Jefferson's chief tormentor, the ever-resourceful John Marshall, who had somehow found time while serving as Chief Justice to publish between 1804 and 1807 a five-volume biography of George Washington. Adams, who might have been expected to find Marshall's Federalist interpretation to his liking, instead described the mammoth work as a mausoleum 100 feet square at the base and 200 feet high, and predicted that it would prove as durable as the Washington Benevolent Society's. In other words, it would sink from its own weight and ponderous prose. But Jefferson was just as certain that Marshall's biography, which was based on Washington's actual correspondence and benefited from Marshall's reputation for thoroughness and probity, would establish itself as the closest thing to an official history of the era. Marshall's narrative followed a storyline that Jefferson considered an artful lie. The most offensive fifth volume offered this summary statement. The continent was divided into two great political parties, the one of which contemplated America as a nation and labored incessantly to invest the federal head with powers competent to its preservation of the Union. The other attached itself to the state authorities, viewed all the powers of Congress with jealousy, and assented reluctantly to measures which would enable the head to act in any respect independently of the members. Men of enlarged and liberal minds arranged themselves generally in the first party. Marshall was arguing a constitutional interpretation that depicted the political coalitions of the 1790s as products of the conflicting perceptions of the constitutional settlement of 1787-88. For Jefferson, on the other hand, the core differences were more ideological than constitutional. The seminal decades were the 1770s, when the true faith was declared, and the 1790s, when it was betrayed. As he put it, the real difference was not federal versus state authority, but different degrees of inclination to monarchy or republicanism. Given Madison's understandable reluctance to devote his retirement years to the task of countering Marshall's history, Jefferson was thrown back upon his own devices. In 1818, he decided to edit and bound together for posthumous publication three volumes of private letters, notes, and memoranda from his years as Secretary of State, thereby creating an archival trail designed to lure subsequent historians away from the false path blazed by Marshall. The modern editors of Jefferson's papers suggest that we call these documents Jeffersoniana instead of the term used by earlier editors, the Annas, which is Latin for a collection of anecdotes, table talk, and gossip. Whatever we call them, Jefferson's edited notes, made, as he recalled, in 1818 on loose scraps of paper taken out of my pocket in the moment and, therefore, ragged, rubbed, and scribbled as they were intended to have the look and sound of the real history. These were the secret stories and covert conversations that occurred in corridors and behind closed doors, where the real decisions were made, the real arguments were hammered out, the real power was exercised. Jefferson's clear purpose was to suggest that Marshall's account of the Washington administration was only the official version. It never got beneath the polite surface to the messier truths. Jefferson was planting in the record his own handmade explosive device, designed to go off after he was dead and expose the Marshall history as a Federalist fable. His Annas, or Jeffersoniana, might be construed then as our early American version of such 20th-century revelations as the Pentagon Papers. Jefferson's story, which he wanted posterity to know as his final testament of the true history of revolutionary America, took the form of a melodramatic plot populated by schemers, conspirators, and corrupt connivers, all driven by a dedication to intrigue. He cast himself in the role of the American innocent, recently returned from his long absence in France, who discovers upon his arrival in New York City in 1790 that the Republican principles he has been cherishing so faithfully have in fact been abandoned by a majority of the officials in the Washington administration. At almost all the dinner parties he attended soon after his arrival, the conversation turned toward the subject of monarchy, how its restoration offered the only hope for political stability, and how Washington needed to be persuaded to accept the royal mantle. When Jefferson tried to make the case for a kingless version of a Republican government along the lines intended in 1776, he claimed he could scarcely find a single co-advocate unless some old member of Congress happened to be present. The old band of brothers had been replaced by a gang of closet royalists. Hamilton was the arch-monarchist, indeed, not only a monarchist, but for a monarchy bottomed on corruption. Even Adams, the old war horse of 76, had been taken up by the monarchical Federalists, who played on his notorious vanity and political ambition to make him a stalking horse for the Hamiltonians. The evidence for all this consisted of multiple anecdotes, hearsay reports of private conversations, and reliable gossip about what one cabinet member claimed to have heard Hamilton or his cronies whispering to each other over port and cigars. It was crucial for Jefferson's conspiratorial version of history to claim that Washington himself was oblivious to the plot. This was not easy to do, since Washington was the unquestioned leader of the Federalists and the alleged candidate for coronation by all the other members of the cabinet. Jefferson's solution was to suggest that Washington was unaware of much that was going on around him. His image of Washington had never been all reverence and flattery. His mind was great and powerful, Jefferson observed, without being of the very first order. His conversational talents were not above mediocrity, and in many public situations, when called for a sudden opinion, he was unready, short, and embarrassed. He was, in effect, more a man of action than deep understanding. That made him susceptible to clever and crafty intriguers like Hamilton. Jefferson also devoted a substantial portion of his secret history to providing an account of his many private meetings with Washington, in all of which the latter showed himself to be in complete agreement with Jefferson about the need to establish pure republicanism. Even those infamous presidential levees, where Washington supposedly held court like an American king, were misleading. Washington's private secretary had told the attorney general, who had told Madison, who then told Jefferson, that Washington despised the royal trappings of these occasions. No matter what Marshall's official or officious biography said, Washington's deepest sentiments agreed completely with Jefferson's. It was a rather extraordinary revelation and a stunning piece of revisionist history, but the elemental truth about America's most elemental hero was that he subscribed wholeheartedly to the Republican rather than Federalist persuasion. Although this attempt to capture Washington from the Federalists, indeed to make Washington a Jeffersonian, was, to put it most politely, a highly problematic version of American political history, Jefferson was absolutely correct to recognize that, in the history wars as in the political wars of the 1790s, whoever had Washington on their side possessed a decisive advantage. Unfortunately for Jefferson's purposes, the early editor of his papers never published the documents he had edited in 1818 in the format he had intended. As a political bombshell designed to detonate after he was gone, the Annas, or Jeffersoniana, proved to be a dud. Historians have not been sure how to categorize it, what to say about it, even what to call it. The best of the most recent scholarly appraisals sees it as a graphic example of the way political gossip shaped the ideological alignments in the early republic, also as another illustration of how the unprecedented and still fragile character of political institutions in the 1790s generated a conspiratorial mentality on all sides, indeed a level of mutual suspicion and intrigue that looks utterly paranoid to us, at least until we recognize how uncertain and unstable the political world of post-revolutionary America looked to them. For our purposes, however, Jefferson's retrospective on the old party battles for the soul of the American Revolution reveals more about how his mind worked than about the battles themselves. Even in his old age, when one might have expected nostalgia and the misty accumulations of sentiment between then and now to have produced a certain mellowing tendency, he remained a dedicated political warrior. Even with Adams urging him in his irresistibly unbridled way to give up the simple moral categories of us versus them, he clung to those categories more tenaciously than ever. The primal colors of his political imagination remained black and white. The story of the American Revolution that he saw in his head remained, as it had been in 1776, a moralistic melodrama. Whatever final adjustments or accommodations he might be tempted to make, as concessions to history's bedeviling complexity, would have to occur within that non-negotiable moral framework. There were, in fact, several such adjustments, all the product of the increasingly retrospective character of his writing in the last decade. In 1821, he spent 6 months working on his autobiography, carrying the story from his birth up to 1790, where the secret history he had compiled from his notes would presumably take over the narrative. He chose not to write anything at all about his presidency. The autobiography was devoted to retelling two familiar stories in the way he wanted them remembered. The first was about the drafting and subsequent debate in the Continental Congress over the Declaration of Independence. He not only wanted to clarify for all time his authorship of the seminal document, but also to reproduce his original draft before it was edited by the Congress. In effect, he delivered in his autobiography the defense of his original language that his congenital shyness had prevented him from delivering on the floor of the Congress at the time. He also made a point of insisting, against the testimony and memory of everyone else, that all the delegates actually signed the declaration on July 4th. It was obviously important to him to certify the historical accuracy of the date subsequently celebrated as the nation's birthday. The second story was about the coming of the French Revolution. Here his chief purpose was to counter the charge, which his Federalist critics had made into a familiar refrain, that he had contributed to the radical utopianism of those French philosophes who led France into a bloodbath, or at least had drifted toward disaster with them in the dreamy days before the guillotine. His version of the crucial months emphasized the responsible character of the moderate French aristocrats led by Lafayette. The French Revolution would have been a bloodless and wholly peaceful transition, Jefferson argued, but for the cowardice and indecision of Louis Capet. And the king's failure to side with the future rather than the past was, he claimed, largely the result of his wife's influence over him. "I have ever believed," Jefferson wrote, "that had there been no queen, there would have been no revolution." The entire tragedy was due not to long-standing historical forces that proved unmanageable, but to the ill-timed meddling of one woman. Beyond the boundaries of his autobiography, mostly in his extensive and increasingly burdensome correspondence, he attempted to make three significant modifications in the way he wished to be remembered. The first represented a revision of his much-quoted tribute to the agrarian life initially published in his Notes on Virginia. He wanted it known, and gave permission to be quoted on the matter in the newspapers, that the world had changed dramatically since he wrote Notes, when he had urged Americans to till the land and shun any and all forms of manufacturing. "We must now place the manufacturer by the side of the agriculturist," he acknowledged, endorsing a commitment to small-scale domestic manufacturing or home industry. Anyone who opposed this modest shift in America's economy was out of touch with reality and must be for reducing us either to dependence on that foreign nation, England, or to be clothed in skins and to live like wild beasts in dens and caverns. On the other hand, he did not want to be misunderstood on this point, America should remain a predominantly agricultural economy and society. Domestic manufacturing was permissible, but large factories should be resisted. Most important, the English model of a thoroughly commercial and industrial society in which the economy was dominated by merchants, bankers, and industrialists should be avoided at all costs. "We may exclude them from our territory," he warned, "as we do persons afflicted with disease," going so far as to recommend that if one region of the United States should ever become thoroughly commercialized, the remaining agrarian region should secede in order to remain immune to the attendant corruptions. He conceded that his insistence on an agrarian character may be the dreams of an old man, or that the occasion of realizing them may have passed away without return. But the goal of all statesmen dedicated to the values that he cherished most should be to preserve as much of the agrarian character of America as possible. If that turned out to mean merely delaying the inevitable, so be it. A second significant clarification concerning his religious convictions. The Federalist press and New England clergy had been particularly vicious on this score during his presidency, citing his friendship with Tom Paine and his historic stance against any connection between church and state as evidence that he was probably an atheist and certainly not a Christian. In 1816, he announced the completion of what he called a wee book, which was really an outline for a book entitled The Morals and Life of Jesus of Nazareth. The culmination of a similar project begun in 1802, when the attacks on his religious beliefs had begun in earnest, Jefferson intended his sketch of Jesus as moral exemplar to be a document in proof that I am real Christian, that is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus. What he really meant was that he admired the moral values embodied in the life of Jesus, but preferred to separate what is really his from the rubbish in which it is buried, much in the way as the diamond from the dunghill. Primitive Christianity, in his view, was similar to the original meaning of the American Revolution, a profoundly simple faith subsequently corrupted by its institutionalization. In the case of the Christian denominations, the metaphysical abstractions of Athanasius and the maniacal ravings of Calvin, tinctured plentifully with the foggy dreams of Plato, have so loaded it with absurdities and incomprehensibilities that it was almost impossible to recover its native simplicity and purity. He was particularly harsh on Yale, Harvard, and Andover as seminaries of despotism. If he had been completely scrupulous, he would have described himself as a deist who admired the ethical teachings of Jesus as a man rather than as the Son of God. In modern-day parlance, he was a secular humanist. But by insisting on his status as a quasi-Christian, or at least placing on the record his personal acceptance of the term, he blunted one of the most pointed challenges to his prominent place in the mainstream of American history. Finally, Jefferson's twilight retrospecting allowed him to see his own political achievement from a more long-range perspective and therefore to talk about it in a new idiom. The act of preparing his secret history of the 1790s, for instance, required him to revisit and then reiterate his sense of the Revolution as a liberation movement to free America not just from English tyranny, but from all forms of political oppression. This movement was halted and almost overturned by the Federalists in the 1790s, then was rescued and revived by the Republicans in 1800. In a sense, he had always carried this storyline around in his head, but in old age he saw it even more clearly enough, in fact, to give its climax a name. In 1819, for the first time, he used the phrase, the Revolution of 1800, to describe his own election, claiming that it was as real a revolution in the principles of our government as that of 1776 was in its form. The act of providing a fresh descriptive label for his ascendance to the presidency did not really alter his long-standing belief in its significance, but it did make the event more memorable and give his version of history a more accessible handle. Subsequent generations of historians did not fail to grab it, thereby implicitly endorsing the Jeffersonian interpretation of the entire Revolutionary era. Coining a new phrase is not the same thing, of course, as discovering a new idea. Starting in 1816, however, there is a clear trail of evidence in Jefferson's correspondence to indicate that he was thinking about what he called the principles of 1776 in new ways. Again, the correspondence with Adams may have prompted this development, since Adams had remarked in a much-quoted aside that the term republicanism was one of those weasel words that different people understood to mean different things. Jefferson's most familiar formulation tended to follow his binary system of political thought, juxtaposing republican and monarchy. But then, leaving the matter at that, not specifying what republican meant beyond the elimination of royal prerogatives and divine right presumptions of power. Indeed, one of the most alluring features of Jefferson's formulation was its eloquent silence on the whole question of what a republican government actually entailed. Adams had written 4 fat volumes on this very subject, and Madison had given the matter equivalent analytical attention in the Federalist Papers. Perhaps the most beguiling facet of Jefferson's habit of mind was its implicit assumption that one need not worry or even talk about such complex questions, that the destruction of monarchy and feudal trappings led naturally to a new political order. The best name for that new order had always been Republican. By 1816, he began to find this language inadequate. In truth, the abuses of monarchy had so filled all the space of political contemplation, he remarked, that we imagined everything republican which was not monarchy. But subsequent events demonstrated that we had not yet penetrated to the mother principle, that governments are republican only in proportion as they embody the will of the people and execute it. He made the same point in a slightly different way to John Taylor, his fellow Virginian and even more fervent agrarian enthusiast. The further the departure from direct and constant control by the citizens, the less has the government the ingredient of republicanism. In answer to the Adams claim that republicanism may mean anything or everything, Jefferson apprised Taylor that the true doctrine was that governments are more or less republican as they have more or less of the element of popular election and control in their composition. Whatever evils might flow from what he called the duperies of the people were infinitely less threatening or injurious than those from the egoism of their agents. Without fully realizing it at the time, he and his fellow revolutionaries in 1776 had launched a political movement whose full implications were only now seeping into conscious articulation. Here, for the first time, Jefferson embraced the idea that would eventually, and then everlastingly, be associated with his name. What he had always called pure republicanism was really democracy, and what he had actually done in the Revolution of 1800 was to restore the democratic impulse of the American Revolution after its betrayal by the Federalists. In a sense, pretty much as Jefferson claimed, the democratic implications of the American Revolution had been there all along, but once he began to feel more comfortable with the term, describing all Americans, for instance, as constitutionally and conscientiously Democrats, the very usage of the term forced a fuller explication of its portentous significance and cast a new light over his old attitudes toward government. The voluntary consent of the individual citizen, it was now clear, was the elemental principle and political power source. Jefferson's level of mistrust toward the different branches of the federal government had followed naturally from this principle. The federal courts were the furthest removed from popular consent, and he hated them the most. The Senate came next, followed closely by the President, then the House of Representatives. The state legislatures were then closer to the popular will, County representatives were closer still, and town, or what he called ward officials, stood face to face with the elemental source itself, the semi-sacred will of the people. Jefferson's idealization of local government as the epitome of the democratic experience was probably connected to a statewide educational scheme he was devising for Virginia about this time, more on this shortly, that divided each county into 10 or 12 wards, where he wanted state-supported primary schools established. The intimate face-to-face character of government at the ward level helped Jefferson visualize the democratic essence. Almost every other political thinker of note in America, especially and exhaustively Adams and Madison, had begun with the presumption that the intimacy of local politics could not be replicated at the national level, which therefore required different and more complex political principles and institutional mechanisms to work effectively, indeed, to work at all. But Jefferson did not think about politics in this conventional fashion. For him, democracy was to politics as agrarianism was to the economy or health was to the human body. It could never be completely perfect, but the more of it, the better. His discovery of the wards as the primal democratic unit or the pure and elementary republics led him to what we might call a theory of democratic contagion. Combine the wards and they will congeal to form a democratic state. Then, as the states interact to form a nation, they will make the whole a true democracy. In general, the depictions of democracy he provided in his correspondence after 1816 tended to operate at imaginary extremes. On the one hand, there was the individual voter in the town or ward, registering his personal preference. On the other, there was an impersonal and faceless aggregate called the people. When pressed to sharpen the focus on the people, he developed an explanation based on who was not in the picture. Infants and children were obviously excluded, as were women who could not mix promiscuously in the public meetings with men. Slaves were also absent, on the principle that those who have no will could be permitted to exercise none in the popular assembly. The picture of the people that he saw in his head then included qualified citizens only. On the question of whether citizenship required the ownership of property, he remained silent until near the very end. In 1824, however, in response to a request about the revision of the Virginia Constitution, he came out in favor of the elimination of the property requirement for voting, saying it disenfranchised men who otherwise were expected to serve in the militia. His final verdict on the social composition of the people, then, was that it included all the adult white males of the population. When not pressed, however, Jefferson preferred to keep the focus fuzzy. Specific questions about who should vote missed the larger point, which was that, thanks to the American Revolution, consent had replaced coercion as the operative principle of government, and political power, if it aspired to become legitimate authority, needed to pass muster with a majority of the citizenry. Efforts to clarify the somewhat misty and mystical notion of the people or the will of the people never made much headway with him, perhaps suggesting that he understood that if democracy were to become a political religion, it needed to preserve a sense of mystery at the core. He even opposed efforts to organize discrete interest groups to represent segments of the popular will to the federal government, what we would now call lobbyists. He regarded such associations as dangerous machines, which should be frowned down as mere clubbists of Washington, that were unnecessary, presumptuous, and of dangerous example. The sprawling and inchoate character of popular opinion, it seems, was one of its chief blessings, not to be tampered with, orchestrated, or analyzed. Even the term democracy itself, though he used it more frequently in those latter years, never achieved a secure and prominent place in his political vocabulary, retaining, as it did for him, some of the old 18th-century connotations of mob rule or anarchy, which he obviously opposed, or conveying to the younger generation, especially Westerners, the rightful ascendance of ordinary citizens to public office, which he